Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us again today. Really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. So much to get to over the next hour, including new numbers and new vaping-related deaths in Missouri and Illinois. We'll also talk about a potential new hope in Alzheimer's research. And we'll find out more about the type of brain surgery President Jimmy Carter underwent earlier in the week. But first, let's welcome in our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for being here again.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk to you about some new research out of Stanford University, giving new hope to kids and grown-ups who are allergic to peanuts.
The study indicates that one injection of an antibody let people with severe peanut allergies eat a nut's worth of peanut protein 2 weeks after the shot. About 32 million Americans suffer from food allergies. The only current treatment is oral immunotherapy. It takes 6 months to a year and can cause allergic reactions.
What do you think about that? Another way to maybe treat peanut allergies?
Well, I mean, it's you know, all these new things are exciting, and certainly you hope it leads to a cure, at least for people to at least go about their daily life without the worry of a bomb of a anaphylactic or severe allergic reaction happening. With all these, when you hear about a new study or a new drug, the most important thing is just doing this and studying it in a very specific way. And what you do with this is just making sure you study the drug against usually a placebo and making sure that you know, the benefits outweigh the harms, and that science is very clear. So, I mean, that's what's needed next in these types of discoveries. I guess the caveat being with peanut allergy, you don't want to have a placebo and have somebody eat peanuts because that might be bad. But nonetheless, you know, it's exciting, and it certainly makes sense, and it's got a lot of biologic sense. And hopefully it's on the way to at least having people be able to cope with this in a better way.
We also heard this week that the government believes that twice as many Americans now are killed by antibiotic-resistant bacteria as previously thought.
Antibiotic-resistant bacteria and fungi cause more than 2.8 million infections and 35,000 deaths in the U.S. each year. CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield calling it a deadly threat.
Antibiotic resistance threatens both our nation's health and our global security.
Every 11 seconds, someone gets an antibiotic-resistant infection, says the CDC, and every 15 minutes, somebody dies. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
I'm sure this is one of your favorite things to talk about, antibiotic resistance.
Oh, you guessed right. So, again, this is a huge problem, and there's really a number of different reasons. First and foremost, I think, you know, when I'm in clinic and I see patients and they're sick, and you know, the advantage of seeing somebody in clinic who doesn't feel well is the large percentage of time it's almost always a viral illness, particularly in the winter time when everybody's inside and sneezing on each other. I mean, most of what I see in clinic are viral illnesses, and there are some specific criteria that I think of when I need to give antibiotics. But the reason I, in my practice, and a lot of my colleagues are very stingy is not because we don't want to get you better or have you feel better. It's just the fact that, A, they don't help you, and B, they lead to this problem. And the other big issue with antibiotics is not many are in the pipeline. There's no money in it. And so, you know, drug companies are looking for drugs, you know, and this is the way the market is they're looking for drugs they can give you for the rest of your life. That's the money. When it's a drug that we give you for a week or two to cure an infection, it's hard to do the work to discover new drugs and develop them and test them. It's a very expensive proposition. And so there's not many in the pipeline. And that, frankly, is what scares me more than the fact that there's resistant drugs. It's like, we're going to run out of tools to deal with this. And, selfishly, I work in a hospital. I'm exposed to this. And so if I ever got sick, it's probably going to be something that's going to be difficult to deal with. And, you know, I want to get treated too.
So what's the answer?
So, you know, I think the biggest thing is it starts with simple things. And you know, when you're feeling ill, you know, again, I always get the, can I have the Z-Pack is the often thing I get asked for. And, you know, I hate to say it, unless there's very specific, clear conditions, it's not going to do much. And even if you have a pneumonia, unless you're incredibly sick, your body's probably pretty capable of dealing with that with or without antibiotics. And what antibiotics do, honestly, with simple things we see all the time, a sore throat, a ear infection, a nasal infection, is they probably shorten the duration of symptoms by about a day. And that, you know, all I deal with is risk and benefits. And to me, the risk and benefit of doing these types of things is really, it's really high risk and low benefit, in my mind.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchhold. He's a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. We heard another story this past week about the benefit of getting a flu shot, especially for people with cardiac conditions.
It could be one of the best health investments you'll ever make, especially if you're one of the nearly 50% of American adults suffering from some form of cardiovascular disease. Research shows an annual flu shot is a cheap and easy way to prevent illness and death in heart patients. Yet the American Heart Association says nearly 1 in 3 don't bother getting one. It's joining with the American Lung Association and the American Diabetes Association in urging all Americans living with chronic health conditions to get that flu shot.
So a lot of benefit to a flu shot beside preventing the flu?
Well, and I want to say this saying, I'm a skeptic, not a cynic. And I learned that quote today, so I'm using it. You know, first of all, get your flu shot. And we've talked before, I think, on previous times about the benefit of it and just what flu can do, particularly when you're at risk of getting sick or have other diseases. These types of studies, when they do them, they're demonstrating an association. So in other words, people that get the flu shot seem to have less incidence or less onset of cardiovascular disease. That being said, people that get flu shots are the type of people that are seeing their doctor and probably more adherent to their medicines. And so there's a lot of overlap in terms of reasons for why you see this benefit. So to prove causation, and, you know, we talked last week, I was in Philly, this is all we talked about, which, you know, for a nerd like me is very exciting, for people listening, probably not so much, but this idea of proving causation is much harder. So I don't think saying getting a flu shot will prevent cardiovascular disease. I think getting a flu shot is overall part of your health, and healthy habits tend to reduce, you know, diseases that occur as a result of unhealthy habits, such as cardiovascular disease.
Big recall this past week. Consumers are being urged to check their refrigerators for an expanding list of vegetable products that may be contaminated with listeria.
Whole Foods has issued a recall of 70 different items due to possible listeria contamination. The recall covers an array of vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower, as well as fish, chicken, and Chinese food items that were available on the store salad or hot bars or in-store prepackaged containers. Contaminated products were sold between October 10th and November 4th of this year.
So how do you protect yourself against listeria?
Great question. Don't buy those products, I guess, is the first thing. But I guess the bigger question is, how do you know? This goes back to, again, when you buy produce, and again, buying fresh produce is healthy. It's a great way to get your vitamins and nutrients. You know, but most things are grown with some degree of pesticides and fertilizers that are just part of the modern farming process. And so at any time, you need to wash your fruits and vegetables before you consume them. I think the simplest thing is water, but I know a lot of people advocate for soap and water. I think things like broccoli and cauliflower are even a little bit harder because it's just harder to wash that type of stuff. And then I guess on top of that, cooking it properly, making sure it gets the right temperature when you're worried about that would help too. But, you know, these things, it's just hard to deal with and hard to know. You know, I think those basic things are there. But then again, when you have these recalls, pay attention to them, certainly.
A new study finds more kids are getting hurt jumping on trampolines these days.
The American Academy of Pediatrics reports broken bones suffered on trampolines are up about 4% in the U.S. thanks to the growing popularity of trampoline parks. The study finds children are 32% more likely to suffer bone fractures on a trampoline at a gym or places like Bounce than they are in a backyard. Engineers say the way the trampolines are connected to each other transfers energy between them, making them more unstable and dangerous. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
Any tips for parents there?
I guess don't go. I've taken my kids to these places too, and my wife and I kind of joked about it. My kids have a great time, but you do kind of wonder about whether or not they're really safe for your children. So we try to keep a good eye on things, and like an idiot, I get on there and jump around with them, and I end up getting hurt more than they do. I keep on preaching the idea of risk versus benefit, and you know, I think it's great that your kids are active and you get them out doing types of things, and trampoline is really kind of a surprisingly difficult exercise if you do it for a while. It's good for the legs, but you know, in these big places, and if they're really busy and there's lots of people running around, you know, it just compounds the risk for injury, and you just got to weigh that. Every parent's got to make their own decision, I suppose.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Great. Always glad to do it.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. When we come back, we'll take a closer look at some new vaping-related deaths and injuries. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. On the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. New numbers this week on vaping-related lung injury deaths. One new case in Missouri, one new case in Illinois. That's two for the state of Missouri and four in Illinois. At least 42 deaths now in 24 states, including more than 2,100 injuries in every state except Alaska. This past week, attention focused on Detroit, where doctors are saying more about the first double lung transplant performed because of vaping damage.
The double lung transplant was done last month on a teenager.
What I saw in his lungs is nothing that I've ever seen before, and I've been doing lung transplants for 20 years.
Dr. Hassan Nemi led the surgical team.
There was an enormous amount of inflammation and scarring, in addition to multiple spots of dead tissue.
He says the 17-year-old patient is making a good recovery. It's not clear what the teenager vaped or for how long. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Joining us now to talk more about this is Dr. Mohsin Ehsan. He's a pulmonologist with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. Dr. Ehsan, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Ehsan, what do you think about a double lung transplant? Are things that bad when it comes to vaping?
That is usually our last resort when we are dealing with patients who have lung issues. And they're available, but this is not something that is done commonly. So you can tell that this is no joke. Vaping-related lung injury, which is now, there is a term for it called EVALI, which stands for e-cigarette or vaping-associated lung injury, is a real deal.
And we also recently learned that the CDC has narrowed down the possible cause for these illnesses.
A significant finding in the lung injuries and deaths linked to vaping.
Vitamin E acetate was found in all 29 samples tested.
The CDC's Dr. Ann Schuchat says no other potential toxins have been found in the testing so far. However,
it's important to note that these findings do not rule out other possible compounds or ingredients that may be causing these lung injuries.
Sabrina Cupid for CBS News, Atlanta.
Dr. Ehsan, what do you think about the vitamin E acetate connection?
So we know that, as you reported, that all 29 cases had, from 10 states actually, had vitamin E in their fluid samples from their lungs. Vitamin E is commonly used in skincare products as supplements. It is safe to apply on skin and swallow, but we know now that inhaling the oily vitamin is not a good idea. It is extremely sticky and stays in lung, causing severe inflammatory response and causes severe lung injury. As a result, people ending up in ICU requiring ventilator, and now we know that people have undergone transplant as well. So it causes severe lung injury, culminating in severe damage to the lung.
And tell us again, when is vitamin E safe to use?
It is a part of some skincare products, so it can be used on the skin. Vitamin E can be swallowed as pill, as supplement, but certainly not in the lung, where it induces such a significant inflammatory response, and it tends to stay in there for a long time.
And it's also found in THC?
So that is used as additive in THC. It's not part of the THC.
So what does this reveal about all the different types of substances people are using to vape these days?
So we know that the e-cigarettes were came into market primarily as a safer option and alternative to cigarette smoking, and we know that it has nicotine. Then it has other additives which are preserving the moisture, and that includes propylene glycol, glycerol, and ethylene glycol. And then the other thing that makes it more appealing to youth is flavoring, and there are certain other metals. So when the liquid is heated, it produces vapor, and some of these compounds found in e-cigarettes have been known to cause have cancer-causing potential.
We're talking with Dr. Mohsen Essan. He's a pulmonologist with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. Dr. Essan, how do you approach this topic with your patients?
So I have patients who use e-cigarettes as smoking cessation aid. I encourage them to use safe and approved therapies rather than using vapor or e-cigarettes to help quit. I think youth appear to be more at risk. Now, I mean, having said that, the amount of press, this current outbreak certainly makes our job easier, convincing people to quit vaping. CDC currently recommends not to use any e-cigarette products containing THC. People should not be using any e-cigarette or vaping products, especially containing THC off the streets, and avoid modifying or adding substances to e-cigarettes.
What demographics do you find to be most at risk?
I think the youth are more at risk just because it's not well controlled. We also know that people get it off the streets, and it can be tainted with certain substances that can be potentially lethal, as we know.
Why do you think it's so popular?
I think it has to do with the marketing. It has certainly increased in use since 2010. There has been quite a sharp rise in cigarette smoking in middle and high school students. They tend to be younger, more educated. It's perceived to be trendy, and it actually portrays it as kind of a safe product to use because of those flavorings. Although people don't know, the potential side effects are nicotine exposure, exposure to other toxic agents that are additives, and now we know that it is associated with severe lung injury. And the long-term effects of these products are still unknown. They also make smoking behavior more normal and may eventually result in smoking normal cigarettes as adults.
And it seems to me like I heard this past week, a new study showed that vaping is also really bad for the heart, even worse than smoking regular cigarettes.
And part of it is because the amount of nicotine you inhale, and it can be very high in some of these products, so that is certainly a risk.
Doctor, what's your final thought here? What do you want people to know?
I would suggest anybody who is still smoking e-cigarettes to quit smoking till we know more. We certainly know that vitamin E has been found in those people who had fatalities in cases that we know of. But there could be some other stuff that we don't know yet, and the jury is still open.
Dr. Essan, thanks for joining us again. Dr. Mohsen Essan is a pulmonologist with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. Coming up, why didn't she get Alzheimer's? The answer could hold a key to fighting the disease. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A possible new breakthrough in Alzheimer's research. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Babatunde Olumide. He's a primary care physician and geriatrician with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. Dr. Olumide, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's find out more about this story from CBS News chief medical correspondent Dr. Jonathan LaPook.
It turns out that this woman has two copies that have mutations in a very important gene. It's called APOE3, and for some reason, it's protecting her from getting Alzheimer's. There may be some drug that they figure out because of this mutation that interrupts the normal development of Alzheimer's on the molecular level. Whether it's editing a gene, whether it's giving somebody a drug. In this case, this was an area of the gene that binds with a sugar protein compound that's involved in spreading a protein called tau that's very important in Alzheimer's disease. I'm sure it's going to be a long way off before there's any possible treatment in people, but this is just the kind of discovery that is tantalizing and could lead to some very important therapeutic discovery.
Dr. Olumide, tell me more about this case.
Yeah, so basically the study was done in Colombia, like you mentioned, and they actually studied about 6,000 people from a family of this lady, also her extended family, and they all, about a fifth of them in that family do have Alzheimer's dementia, and they normally get it in their 40s and 50s. But this lady, she's over 70, and the researchers noticed that though she had the abnormal changes of the amyloid plaque in her brain, she did not show the signs of Alzheimer's dementia. And that was quite interesting, and that was how they did some more investigation and found out that she had a gene that protected her against getting Alzheimer's dementia. At least that is what is thought, that the gene protected her. That's what it's thought.
How exciting is a discovery like this?
No, it's very exciting because it gives us hope for treatment of Alzheimer's dementia. I mean, like we know, we do not have many medications that are used in treating Alzheimer's dementia. So this gives us another avenue to do some further research to get drugs that can target the gene and hopefully give us a cure or some treatment of Alzheimer's dementia with medications.
How long of a ways off might this be, though?
Wow, that's the million-dollar question. I think it's time only will tell, but I know it's not like next year or so. I think it will take some time for researchers to get medicines tested and see if it's able to give treatment for Alzheimer's. Because remember, there have been other drugs that have been made in research to treat Alzheimer's dementia, and the drugs unfortunately did not work. So only time will tell, I think. But I think it's not now, if you know what I mean.
Dr. Olumide, why is Alzheimer's so complex and difficult for experts to treat?
Certainly, Alzheimer's dementia is complex and difficult because our understanding of the disease itself is still growing. We don't fully understand the disease, and also it affects people's cognition and also affects causing neuropsychiatric illnesses as well. So it's still an ongoing thing in research to treat Alzheimer's dementia. And it's not just the patient that is involved. We also think about the caregiver, the relations of the patient. So it's quite a complex disease at this time to treat.
Tell me about the role of tau in all of this.
So basically, tau is what we call a neurofibrillary tangle. It's a protein that combines with the amyloid beta, and this is what really causes Alzheimer's dementia and is found in the brains of people who have Alzheimer's. So the whole idea is if we are able to work on the gene like this lady had, and hopefully stop the binding of tau to amyloid, that could help in the treatment of Alzheimer's dementia.
We are talking with Dr. Babatunde Olumide. He's a primary care physician and geriatrician with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County about Alzheimer's and dementia. Dr. Olumide, let's go back to the basics. Give me your general assessment of Alzheimer's. What is it, and how do you identify it?
So basically, Alzheimer's dementia is a deterioration of cognitive abilities that impair your successful performance of your activities of daily living. And when we say activities of daily living, we mean you're functioning as a human being, you're dressing, bathing, cooking, just things you do on a day-to-day basis. So Alzheimer's actually affects that, and the predominant thing it affects is your memory.
And the treatments are very few, correct?
Correct. So I look at Alzheimer's treatment, we put it in two groups. You have the medication treatment and you have the non-medication. So under the medication treatment, we have a few drugs we do use, and they are effective, but more for sometimes mild or moderate Alzheimer's dementia. But unfortunately, they're not always able to give us a cure, if you know what I mean. And certainly, we talk of non-medications. We have things like cognitive stimulation therapy that has been very helpful in patients with Alzheimer's dementia. And we also have to think about treatment of Alzheimer's as also the family and the caregivers as well. Very important, because what happens is there's a lot of burden on the family looking after the patient with Alzheimer's in terms of patient having neuropsychiatric problems, agitation, restlessness. So the family is also a major player in the treatment of Alzheimer's, and also the caregiver as well. So it's a multifaceted form of treatment.
Tell me a little bit more about family and friends. Can they help minimize the impact on the patient?
Oh, certainly they can. Certainly they can. Because, for instance, we know that in Alzheimer's dementia, over the course of the illness, driving becomes an issue, grocery shopping, even paying bills because of the memory problems. So the family will have to step in to drive the patient to where they have to go, get involved with grocery shopping, get involved with cooking, and also managing the patient's finances so that the patient doesn't get ripped off by scammers, and also just to make sure that the patient is able to be protected financially as well.
Dr. Lumide, you deal with patients that have dementia and Alzheimer's all the time. What gets you through it? What's the reward for you?
I think the reward for me is the fact that Alzheimer's, the different stages of the disease, and hopefully we by screening the patients when they come to the clinic, we hope we can catch it early. And by catching it early, we can offer, I'd mentioned cognitive stimulation therapy, and also offer things that to the family to prepare them for the illness so that it's not going to come as a shock or surprise over the course of the illness. So the families are prepared and they can plan for the patient's future and also plan for what the disease can bring in the future as well. So that's really what I like about it, that I'm able to offer preemptive solutions before the disease gets really advanced.
What should people be looking out for? What are some signs and symptoms?
No, certainly I will say that if you notice that a family member or loved one is having problems with short-term memory, also having problems that affect their daily activities because of poor memory, and even behavioral problems. If you find out that your family or member or loved one is wandering out of the house at night or behaving more agitated, more restless, they should be evaluated for sure. They should be evaluated.
Dr. Lumide, anything else you want to add?
The only other thing I will add is that I believe that early detection through screening tests like the Mini Mental Status Exam, the St. Louis University Mental Status Exam, to catch early Alzheimer's dementia, I think is a good option so that we don't wait till the disease is far advanced. So I think it's good to catch it early.
Dr. Lumide, thanks a lot. Enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Babatunde Olumide is a primary care physician and geriatrician with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. When we come back, we'll talk about the type of brain surgery that former President Jimmy Carter underwent this past week. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Do you know what a subdural hematoma is? We heard a lot about that this past week. Here to talk with us about it is Dr. Jerome Coppins. Dr. Coppins is a SLU care neurosurgeon at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Coppins, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Wanted to talk with you about former President Jimmy Carter, who underwent surgery this past week to relieve some bleeding in his brain, which I believe he may have had after a series of falls over the past year. First off, tell me, what is this bleeding in the brain? What causes it?
So subdural hematomas are usually caused by any form of traumatic injury to the brain. Falling can be a common cause. It can also be linked to the fact that more and more of the population is now on blood thinners, and so the risk goes up as you age with a combination of blood thinners and some form of mechanical hit to your head.
Tell me about the type of surgery that takes place when a patient has a subdural hematoma.
Yeah, so subdural hematomas come a little bit in different flavors. So, you know, there, you can have an acute subdural hematoma, which you typically see more in high-velocity car injuries, which is not the type that President Carter has. But then over time, what you can have is you can also have this blood perpetuate itself and have a more chronic fluid collection on the surface of the brain, and that's called a chronic subdural hematoma. And so, you know, the treatment options vary from having to do a bigger operation to actually drain the blood. Once the blood becomes a little more liquid, then there's options of doing things that are a little bit smaller, where you can just drain a small hole and put a catheter in the fluid space between the brain and the skull, and that's where you can drain then a subdural hematoma. And so, you know, there's quite a range based on the consistency of the blood and the size of the subdural hematoma that will lead you to treat them differently.
So the bigger ones are called craniotomies or craniectomies?
Yeah, so when you have an acute subdural hematoma, the issue is that the blood is very thick, so then just it's not possible to drain it without opening the whole head, so that's called a craniotomy. If the brain is very swollen, sometimes we actually then do not put the bone back on just to give the brain enough room to be able to swell up and have keep its normal pressure, and that's called a craniectomy. And the more chronic stages, then there's options of doing what's called a burr hole, which is really just drilling the hole and then putting a subdural drain, which is the drain that will then drain the rest of it over the next days. And more now we also have some hybrid versions where we do endoscopically assisted, mini craniotomies. So we just do a very small opening of the head, and then with an endoscope, in some cases we can go and really be more aggressive in removing the subdural hematomas. And so every patient is tailored to, you know, his scans and his exam to really make the best decision as to, you know, how to successfully treat the subdural hematoma in that case.
How risky is this type of surgery?
Yeah, well, so the risk has to do with whether or not you have underlying damage in your brain. These subdural hematomas can come in association with also other injuries in the brain, especially when you have a high-velocity acute subdural hematoma. In the chronic stages, then, it's more the issue about, you know, having to successfully drain the hematoma and not leave some behind so you don't run the risk of it keeping on accumulating. These can be done under general anesthesia. They can also be done awake. So I think, you know, in my view, for elderly population who have chronic subdural hematomas, I think there's more and more of a shift of going away from doing the big surgeries under general anesthesia and trying to do these more, you know, catered, minimally invasive approaches under local anesthesia or what's called conscious sedation, because that's really where the biggest risk is, really about the risk of just undergoing the general anesthetic, the fact that patients then have decreased level of consciousness, and then a lot of the complications afterwards come down from having aspiration pneumonias or being in bed, and that's really what then complicates a little bit that elderly population, with the risk of the surgery. The technical portion of doing a burr hole and just draining the subdural hematoma is actually fairly straightforward, but of course, when you age, you know, the risks of surgery in general do go up.
We're talking with Dr. Jerome Coppins. He's a SLU care neurosurgeon at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Coppins, how common is a subdural hematoma?
Oh, it is very common. We see patients every day coming to the hospital with subdural hematoma, and it's actually increasing in frequency just because life expectancy is increasing, and so much of the population now, because of stroke prevention or because of underlying cardiac disease, have to be on blood thinners. It exacerbates the problem because, you know, it may not even take a very significant injury to your head, and it may be just something in day-to-day life where you just hit your head on a door or on a cupboard, and in the moment it may not be that obvious to you, and we see patients who, you know, these things then escalate into eventually getting chronic subdural hematoma that may still need to be drained. So it's something we see very commonly in the population at this point.
What are the symptoms of a subdural hematoma?
So the symptoms, you know, in chronic subdural hematoma is going to be more something that will slowly kind of come up where you'll have some headaches. You're not going to feel as well. You may be a little bit confused. And over time, if you start having things like nausea and vomiting, those are warning signs that the pressure in your head is increasing. Occasionally, it can give you a seizure, but that's less common. And then if it continues to go, then you may start to have some weakness on one side of your body. And if you have that progression where just from day to day or every couple of days, you realize that you're getting worse with a bad underlying headache, then that's a reason to go to hospital and get a CT scan.
What's the recovery process like after treatment for subdural hematoma?
So, the biggest factor is how awake you are at the time of diagnosis. And so if you're still very awake, you're in the early stages where it's showing some pressure on the brain, but you're still very awake, your recovery is probably going to be faster because you're going to regain your level of consciousness faster, and you may be able to go home after a few days in the hospital. Now, if it's a more advanced subdural hematoma where you have weakness or your level of consciousness is greatly decreased, then that might be a little bit more involved where you may be in the hospital for, about a week or so, and that may lead to then having to go to rehab for a little bit. And the biggest issue about, the mortality involved with these procedures is really about if these subdural hematomas reaccumulate, then that's where you can really have an acute problem there that can become a life threatening event. But that's luckily very uncommon. But there are still some people that can die from a subdural hematoma, so it's not to be taken lightly.
And I guess thinking of the age of President Carter, he's 95. Age is a factor as well?
Yes. So the biggest issue from an age perspective is just the pros and cons about doing a general anesthetic or doing it awake, and then about just you're very sensitive to being on medication. You're going to have to be in the ICU for a couple of days while you're being drained, and that can lead to patients having a higher risk of some delirium and other medical complications between pneumonias of getting blood clots in the legs of just being immobilized and having to be in a hospital for a few days. And that age population is really where those risks do come out.
Dr. Coppens, anything else you think people need to know?
No, I think I would just encourage that, in these kind of diseases, if you have a set of symptoms, it's one of those things where you would rather get scanned fairly early. I think your outcome is really dependent on catching this in the early stages when you have a headache. Maybe you're just not functioning as well. Once you get to the stages where you really have decreased level of consciousness and you have weakness, your outcome is going to be worse. And so I really encourage people, if they do have that set of symptoms, to just get scanned early on, especially if they remember having hit their head in the last couple of weeks. And I think that's really what probably the biggest factor would be in being able to decrease the morbidity and mortality associated with treating subdural hematomas.
Dr. Coppens, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dr. Jerome Coppens is a SLU care neurosurgeon at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join me again next week at this same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.